All right. Welcome to Film Shake. I'm Jordan.
I'm Nick.
And this is episode 2. We're going to talk about the life of Oharu. Have a little trivia battle at the end. See if Nick can dethrone me as trivia king. Take me down.
You might be going down, or you might destroy me again.
We shall see. So stick around for that, definitely. But before we do all that, we're going to have a segment we like to call the Fallen Warrior Review. That's right, where the loser from last time's trivia battle has to come back and report on what they were made to watch. And I don't feel like I did you much disservice here, Nick. I assigned you, after beating you handedly at the trivia battle, I assigned you to watch Chungking Express from Wong Kar-wai in 1994. I listened back to last time's episode with my wife, and she was like, Chungking Express? What? Like the fat people train? I was like, Chungking Express. I guess I should have enunciated there a little better, but yeah, it's Chungking Express. So, Nick, I'm going to chunk that at you. What did you think of
Chungking basically, Express? Last time around in the trivia battle, first you mercilessly beat you down, only to hand me a gigantic sack of candy with this movie.
Nice.
This movie, I remember whenever it kind of, you know, came into the focus of the Western world, Chungking Express, it kind of got advertised as this action movie. And even if you look at the one of the DVD cases for it, one of the quotes they used from a review is nonstop action.
Really?
So I was thinking like, okay, this is like a kung fu movie. Because I don't like to prep before the movie. I like to read about it after, you know, so I'm going in cold. It's not an action movie.
There are
no fight scenes. A gun is fired, I think, one time, and it's not a very high-octane action scene. It just kind of happens. A very living movie. I love movies where you just feel like you're entering this world that's fully put together.
Right.
That focuses on four different people's lives. You get a nice slice of life from each of them.
You have the two stories that both follow lovesick cops. So the first one, guys, kind of sick over this girl that's left him, and then he meets a drug smuggler. And then the second part, you have Tony Leung, who plays also a cop who's also lovesick over a relationship that has fizzled out, and then there's some romance interest between him and a, I guess what you'd call her, like a diner girl, like a, I don't know, like a girl working.
Fei Wong, incredible.
Fei Wong, yeah.
I would have had a huge crush on her. If I had watched this when it came out in 1994 when I was in middle school.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
I would have had a Fei Wong poster on my wall for sure.
Yeah, she's great in it. I mean, beautiful, but also just a very, like, understated actress, too.
And very enigmatic.
Yes, plays that very well.
And I liked how the first policeman, he was like the Asian Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Right.
I feel like if this movie had been made in America like 12 years later,
it would have been him for sure.
Totally. He would have nailed that kind of role. Just this kind of slightly goofy, high energy, really optimistic, romantic guy.
It's like the 500 Days of Summer from Hong Kong.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the vibe I got for the whole first half of the movie with him. And I loved how delusional he was about the you know, other character for his half of the film.
Yeah. What sold me on it was when Tony Leung, cop number two, started talking to his inanimate objects in his apartment, conflating them with himself when he sees a dripping towel as a projection of his own love lost tears. I was sold.
I had to pause the movie because I laughed so hard on that scene.
That was so great.
That was awesome.
And probably for me, the eye of the duck in this film would have been that little slice of a romantic memory we get from cop number two, where we get that playful new romance between him and the stewardess and them, like, making love. And he's got the plane, like, on her back, like, and they're making these little flight metaphors and stuff. And it was so beautiful and poetic, but it's tragic at the same time because this is, like, his that one love that got away. So, I don't know, I just really connected with that memory. And like you said, it all just felt very real and lived in, so... Great film, yeah, definitely. I'm glad you got to see it because of this.
Yeah, yeah. So if you beat me again today, I hope, like, once again that your recommendation is far kinder than the one that, or not recommendation, it's like an order.
An order. Right? Your assignment.
Yes.
Homework assignment.
I hope it's way kinder than the one that maybe I'll just hold on to the entire time we do Film Shake if I never win.
Yeah. Just building up rage.
That's right. I get more mad every show.
Hopefully not. All right, so moving on to The Life of Oharu from 1952. This is our main review today, directed by Kenji Mizoguchi. It's our second Mizoguchi film. We talked about Ugetsu Monogatari on the show last time, and that was incredible. I really enjoyed that Nick picked that film. And so I went ahead and just picked another Mizoguchi that I hadn't seen. And I guess we should set this up a little bit. So Life of Oharu stars Kinuyo Tanaka. Hopefully I said that right as well. I mean, we're struggling here. We're going into foreign territory. So
Literally.
So, but yeah, Tanaka, I'll just call her Tanaka. She plays a lady-in-waiting, a noblewoman, and the film chronicles her fall from grace as she enjoys a love relationship with the always incredible Toshiro Mifune, who plays a samurai or a page that's lower rank than her. And, you know, he kind of persuades her into this love relationship. They're found out, and her whole family are banished from Kyoto, and she then is pretty much sold into prostitution by her father. She becomes a courtesan, which is basically, I'm guessing, like the equivalent of a call girl or, you know, a geisha, an entertainer. And from there on, it's just a downward spiral of men treating her poorly and society in general. Just Mizoguchi painting a broad picture of society and how poor women were treated during this time. It's set in the feudal era, so it's definitely a heavy hitter. It's not one you want to just pop in for a quick breeze into Japanese history. It's definitely got the historical aspect to it, which is rich and detailed, but it's a heavy film. It's emotional. It's got a lot of pathos, and that's probably one of the things that I loved about it the most, was just the emotion that we feel as we watch this character in plight after plight.
Here's how I knew that this was going to be different from maybe another movie from Japan around the same period of filmmaking. So Toshiro Mifune, I've got a journal from 2009, whenever I was, I don't know, 5 years removed from college, where I just talked about my favorite actors, which I don't know where that thing is, but I had him listed as my favorite actor along with the guy from a bunch of Bergman films. He's in Winter Light. I think it's Gunnar Bjornstrand. I don't know. I always blank out on names whenever we're actually, you know, talking. He always had so much swagger. In all the Kurosawa films, he's just swaggers onto the screen. Mm-hmm. And he's got this way of walking where, like, his torso is kind of leaned back. And he's making, like, this, you know, this expression, like, how could the rest of the world even think it could be on the same screen as me? When he walks very meekly and mildly into this film, and then it's not really a spoiler because it happens in the first 20 minutes, gets beheaded, I immediately knew, okay, this is not that kind of movie.
Right.
He's done. He had no swagger. That's over with. And that's it. We focus on Oharu. It is her film. Thanks to him, also, she starts this sort of downward spiral in life.
Right.
She was she's hesitant to start this relationship with him because she knows what will happen, but of course he's, you know, persuades her, "Oh no, we have to, our love is forever. This has to happen. We can't deny our feelings." And she's still resistant, and then, you know, I don't want to say he begs, but he goes on.
He kind of does. He gets down, he's on the ground on his knees like begging her.
There could be a picture of him, you know, next to the word beg in the dictionary of what he does in the movie.
Yeah.
So that happens. They start the relationship. They get found out, and he is he's executed because he's coming from, you know, a lower station in life, and her family is sent into exile and, you know, loses their status, and he really gets off easy.
He really does. Yeah, again, the man in the situation, he just gets beheaded, and he's dead. He's gone, but Oharu is in for the long haul here, and whoa, what a haul it is. I mean, first I wanted to talk about the scene of her receiving Mifune's will and how she runs out into the bamboo forest attempting to commit suicide with a knife or throw herself down a well, and her mother is there to stop her, thankfully. But I was struck that we weren't that far into the film. We don't we didn't really know these characters that well, but just the way it's shot from like a wider, higher up angle, giving us this full view of the forest and Oharu. And I guess it's, I have to lend it to Tanaka, to the actress, just how emotional that scene was and how resonant it was. That was what really just pulled me in and got me interested in the character and in her situation.
So Ogetsu has this more surrealistic edge, obviously. I mean, there are ghosts in the movie. You know, you go into the spirit world and all this stuff. This movie is firmly in the harsh reality, which, again, you know, in Ogetsu, for the women's stories in the film, it was always a harsh reality. It's right. Only the men that get to, you know, kind of live in this fantasy. But one tie that I noticed, he gets into the supernatural only a brief bit. There's a scene a little later that I think we'll talk about. And actually, I kind of want to save for when we do spoilers later.
Yeah. If we didn't mention it already, we'll have a separate spoilers show or spoilers episode for this film as well. Probably it'll come out like a week or so later after this is released. So look for that and give you a chance to see the film. And if you haven't already, and then come prepared to hear about the ending and the big whammies at the end.
That's right, the whammies.
The whammies.
But the one...
we'll call it the whammy episode.
I like it. But the something that connected the films for me is the sound of cranes related to death. Whenever Mifune's character is executed, you can hear this far-off sound that gets louder. And to me, it sounds like a crane to me. It's definitely like a bird-like noise, but it's also kind of the supernatural, like just the sound of like death approaching.
I didn't notice that. That's interesting.
And then as she's running into the woods, you get this kind of, you know, the camera work is great in this movie, like in Ogetsu, but the scale is smaller. You're not like cutting through these forests or like, you know, these samurai battles from war. But the shot where she's running into the woods, the camera tracks her, you know, and it's that more dynamic panning shot. And then the sound of the cranes gets turned up in the audio too. You know, she's seeking death, you know, she's gonna join her already dead lover, which doesn't happen. She gets robbed of killing herself.
Yeah.
But that sound kind of amps up. There are a few minor little supernatural touches like that. They're mostly in the audio or like quick visuals.
Yeah. But
outside of that, this is it's pretty harsh. Real movie.
Yeah, talking about the harsh realism of this film, maybe that's why I connected with it a little bit more than Ugetsu. I love the supernatural elements of Ugetsu, but for me, like I said, there was this singular focus on Oharu and this very realistic portrait of her character and her suffering throughout, you know, over a span of a lifetime for her. So we got to see her in these different roles. We really got to see this character fleshed out and see her in different situations and how she reacts. And, you know, I like, again, Mizoguchi painting with a very humanistic brush where we don't always see her making great choices. You know, she's not like a heroine. You know, she's a forlorn and...
She always has the moral tragic. High ground, even yeah, if she's not making the wisest decision. Right. The moral high ground is almost always hers.
It's always hers, but... Again, she's not a caricature of this great saint who's just being tortured and suffering. She makes different. She's a real person. She's yes. making different choices that sometimes help her case and sometimes don't. But I liked the richness there to her character. We talked last time about Mizoguchi as a director and some of his personal history bleeding into his films. And I thought there was even more so with this one. We talked about how his father made a bad business deal and ended up selling his older sister into prostitution. And, I mean, there's just a direct rip from his life in this film. That basically is what happens here, where the father has made a bad business decision because he thinks his daughter is going to be rich because she's become a concubine to this lord. That doesn't work out like everything else in Oharu's life.
My favorite part about that whole deal, so he sends her off. Actually, I have written larger in my very scattered and nonsensical notes, larger than anything I wrote, actual Disney movie. Because if you look at the plot of this movie, in many ways, there's something that happens here right before her father basically sends her off to, you know, have sex with the Lord and have his baby, you know, and right. just basically be, you know, like cattle.
Mm-hmm.
Before that happens, the Lord sends someone to find a girl for him, and he has these very strict requirements. Like, yeah. she can't have any moles. Her lips have to look exactly like this. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, the arches of her feet have to be so many inches. Like, it's insane.
It's crazy. So, you know, that he does, like, some of that great camera work that he's known for, you know, panning, you know, over all these girls as the mm-hmm. guy is running and looking and inspecting all of them. And then you get this really hypnotic scene where Uharu is out sort of in this kind of field area, and there's music playing, and the guy's looking for the quote-unquote princess. Mm-hmm. This is a Disney plot. This right. is something from, like, an older Disney movie where it's like, the prince wants a woman with no moles and an arch on her feet, like, you know. But this is real. Like,
right. Whereas in a Disney film, it would be painted as, like, picturesque and romanticized, like, oh, she's becoming a princess and it's a wonderful thing and she, you know, lives happily ever after. But here it's like she's being forced into, like, whereas we begin with her, you know, agreeing somewhat with Mifune's character that she should marry for love, and she tells her father, like, you know, I loved him. Why, you know, why is
Which
it
is
wrong
straight,
to love somebody?
Straight Disney again. It's straight, like the Little Mermaid, you know?
Right. I just want to be in love. And this is a relationship based on feelings, not on, like, prearranged conditions. But then she becomes a princess, happens. Quote unquote, because she's being forced into it. It's a prearranged marriage. She doesn't want it, obviously.
Yeah, she has no say in it.
Yeah, she has no say. She's just pretty much forced the whole film. She's just treated like a commodity, basically.
Exactly. She's completely commodified.
Right. And I thought the film did a great job of making that comment on her. And like you said, in that shot of painting over the girls as they're looking for the one with the perfect features, is like, oh no, your eyebrows are too big, or oh no, your forehead's too wide, or whatever. And it's like, man, this is, like you said, treating women like cattle. And Mizoguchi is definitely a feminist in this sense, where he's just pointing out that injustice of how men look at women, how they treat them, how they commodify them. I mean, at one point a character tells her later on, when she has become a courtesan at the pleasure quarters, I guess it's like her new owner there says, you were bought and paid for, no different than a fish on a chopping board. We can serve you up any way we like. And then he goes on to say, he offered you money. What's wrong with that? And again, there's a comment here on money and how women are commodified and paid for.
That's right. And even, I'm only making this connection now, but I wrote down a quote in the film. I think it was Uharu. The nobility makes sport of sincerity, turning it into mere wordplay. That could mean a lot of different things. But looking at it from, like, this Disney's perspective, you know, you could, like, sentimentalize what's happening to her. Like, oh, she was chosen by the prince, or, you know, the Lord in this case. And it's not, this is real life. This is someone having all their choices taken away. She's forced to bear the king a son. And then she's immediately sent home with a pittance. And then I said this was my favorite thing about it. It's an awful thing, but it's just so ridiculous. I almost had to laugh. She gets sent back. Her father sees her and immediately starts crying. He, like, flings himself on the ground. Hmm. He covers himself with a blanket. He's just sobbing mm-hmm. because his daughter has been gone for years. He hasn't seen her. He's had no connection with her. She comes back. Instead of being overjoyed and hugging her, like, oh, I haven't seen you in so long, he's crying because he knows now he's not going to get all the money he thought he was going to get.
He made a bad business deal, and he's in huge debt, and eventually has to sell her off to become a prostitute, just like Mizoguchi's dad. So again, that harsh realism are bleeding in from Mizoguchi's own life. But I will have to say, I liked how, kind of similar to like a Miyazaki film in a way, that there wasn't a singular villain, and there wasn't just like an outright villain, like a evil person versus a good person.
Maybe the system that she was stuck in at most, just because there's not very many avenues for her to ever get out of her situation, but there's not one individual person that you can point a finger at.
It's more of an indictment of a system as a whole, or a society as a whole. So there's an abstraction there. I read that in a review from the site Eye for Film, how Talking about what really elevates Mizoguchi's work in this film in particular is the abstraction of the problem, looking beyond individuals as a set of behaviors and ideals that have no clear progenitor. So it is interesting in that respect. You know, I feel like, again, if you saw an American version of this film, or like a Disney version of this film, there'd definitely be that one standalone villain who's kind of two-dimensional that you could say, oh, yeah, the bad guy.
Just jumping ahead. So I don't think I liked this film quite as much as you did.
Okay.
I liked it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Solid 8 out of 10 for me.
Oh, wow.
One thing that I felt it bordered on was misery porn. It was a bad thing, and then another bad thing, and then another bad thing. And then at one point where it looks like things are getting better, not that it's a contrivance, but something happens that had... something bad happens to her that really, it wasn't just the immediate people around her that caused it to happen, but that makes things get worse for her again. And I got to a point to where I was like, I don't even know if I like this movie. But then there's a scene where it leaves her perspective again, where I felt like it left that realm into something else. And this is a scene which, ironically, it's a scene where she's raped or nearly raped. She's in a room by herself. Someone comes who says that she owes him money, and some things happen.
Mm-hmm.
And he realizes, oh, she's alone. She's very beautiful, and I can do whatever I want right now.
Right.
So, you know, in a movie that was just direct misery porn, you'd probably see some kind of rape happen on screen. It would be very lurid, like, oh, look how bad this is. And, you know, just it would be from the male perspective,
mm-hmm.
you know, kind of like a male gaze type thing,
yeah.
which is awful. But unfortunately, you know, anytime that kind of, you know, plot is broached, usually the director is a man and the perspective is maybe not as empathetic as it should be, even though something horrific is happening. But Mizoguchi leaves the room. He follows the man as he goes outside, and he pays the boy who's watching the room and tells him to go get some sweets.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that he films the scene, it denigrates the man, who should be denigrated. He's about to rape someone.
Yeah.
Instead of, you know, just kind of going into this more misery porn type thing where it's an indictment of the man. It's not just like, look at how awful this person's circumstances are for
right.
Oharu, and I'm going to, you know, debase her with my camera now.
Mm-hmm.
The man is debased instead of her.
Yeah.
And I think when I saw that, I started looking at how he had filmed every time, you know, she's treated harshly and society does things to her. And even though, you know, there's a lot of times where she's having an interaction with someone where the camera angle is coming from behind that person and looking down on her to show that, you know, she doesn't have any power in the situation. But he still finds a way to where she is still maybe on lower social standing, but she has this moral high ground.
Yeah.
And he never debases her as a filmmaker, if that makes any sense.
I hope
I'm articulating myself correctly here.
No, it does. I could see there could be an issue of like, all right, this film is very one note. I could see that criticism where it does just kind of keep on the misery aspect, the sorrow.
I get it.
Think
everything sucks. I gotcha.
Right.
I get it.
Everything sucks for women in feudal Japan. All right. The end. But like I said, there is richness to like the multiple characters that we get to see throughout mm-hmm. the film. And it doesn't only comment on the misery that she suffers at the hands of men. There's also her interactions with the other women and the wives that take her in and the jealousy there. There's also, I don't know, just a lot of poetic foreshadowing. Like I was going to bring up when she meets the vagrant, when she's first coming home, she meets this vagrant who's playing this song, and the vagrant's playing the song and she goes over and asks her, what is that? And the vagrant says like, I'm too ashamed. It's a song I learned when I was a courtesan. And she has just left from being a courtesan. And she's still, there's obviously a striking difference between the two. Oharu is still dressed like a noble lady. She's got a white, bright, clean looking kimono. And this vagrant just looks ratty and dirty and is gray. And there's like this kind of tension there, or this kind of complexity to Ohara's character where we almost kind of see her still trying to put on that facade of, yes, I'm a noble woman, even though she's been disgraced. She's still kind of wearing herself that way. And we don't see it see her kind of completely let go of that facade until later. But there you can kind of see her struggling and almost with the shame of that, where here's this woman out here, very, you know, it's very apparent that she is a vagrant. She's been debauched. She's, you know, not high in society. And here I am with, you know, the situations I've lived through, but I'm still trying to kind of play it cool. And she gives her money even and kind of keeps up the act. But as she walks away, she kind of has this look or this shameful thought almost in her mind. I love how Mizuguchi throughout, there's so many times where, unlike Ugetsu, where I felt like it did border a little bit more on the melodrama, we got more kind of these dramatic soliloquies where characters would just say what had just happened in a very dramatic way. Here he just leaves it up to the images themselves to just speak for that moment.
And also, as a Westerner, I'll just throw this out there, and I'll probably mention this in the spoiler one too, in reference to something. Immediately, as soon as I finished watching this movie, I watched a quick YouTube video of the second round of Rocky IV, just so I could watch someone who was taking a horrible beating get a good punch in.
Oh, nice. Well, what was interesting for me was I watched this Saturday night and then went and saw Captain Marvel on Sunday. So it was like a total trajectory change, where here we have like the plight of women suffering, and then in Captain Marvel we have this very like pro woman, like powerful female superhero, which was like a nice payoff, you know, from this. So it was a good like palate cleanser.
Yeah, that's, now that I think about it, I watched it 2 days after this as well.
Nice.
Very true. But you know, I'd already cleansed myself whenever Rocky cut Ivan Drago above his eye finally.
Nice.
I turned the fight around, so I felt good.
Well, speaking of other film references, I wanted to talk about, to me, there was not a reference, but this had to have directly inspired Miyazaki's Spirited Away. There's a scene where she goes to the geisha establishment. She's become the courtesan, and there's a man who comes in, and he's kind of crass, and they want to turn him away. But then he dumps out all this money, and
Jordan,
everyone
I'm so
starts...
glad that this was what you were talking about earlier, because I saw that too, and I was really scared I missed something.
Okay.
Continue. Go ahead. I'm excited.
But yeah, this man dumps out all this money, and they start groveling at his feet and inviting him in. And that reminded me of Spirited Away. I mean, it had
He's
to be
no
a director.
Face. Yeah.
He is no face. Yeah, from Spirited Away. Like, Miyazaki had to have seen this movie and built that into his own film. And how all the... he starts throwing out the money, and the attendees start grabbing it up. And Oharu doesn't even flinch, just like Chihiro in Spirited Away.
Exactly.
The difference here was that Oharu is not taking the money out of pride, whereas in Spirited Away, Chihiro is just kind of naive and innocent, and that's not what she's there for. She's not interested in money. She just wants to get her parents back. But I like here how Miyazaki uses that to, like, it's her pride at first, but then when she hears that this man is going to buy her freedom, she kind of like gives in and goes up to like sidle up to him and like, oh yeah, you're gonna buy me, you're gonna get me out of here. And he's like, aha, you're such a proud woman, but money can buy you too. But then the money ends up being counterfeit, just like in Spirited Away, right? The money like turns into mud or mush,
and
that.
Just like in Spirited Away, the whole thing starts because, you know, of the father's greed. Right,
yeah.
You know, her dad running off and eating all of the food and Spirited Away got her into the whole mess.
And the same here, her dad, his greed and his huge business debt getting her sent off to become a whore. So
Miyazaki,
I see what you did there, bud.
Throwing knots to classic Japanese cinema.
Yeah,
your country of origin. So that would make complete sense.
Well,
I guess.
Yeah, actually, that's pretty understandable. You want to do your star ratings? I gave it 5 out of 5. Just instantly, I was just like, 5 out of 5 for sure. Loved it. Just hit home. It was really impactful. Really, really strong performance from Tanaka all the way through. Thought she really just dived into that character and had to play so many parts within a part. It was just really well done. How about you? You said 8 out of 10.
I'm in between an 8 and a 9. It really is a great film. His empathy shines through so strongly that even though, you know, I do think it was right on that border to get to misery porn, it never does actually fall into that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a great film. I like Ugetsu just a little more just because I like ghost stories, and maybe that, you know, him being able to incorporate that in while exploring some of the same ideas maybe pushes that a little forward for me. And, you know, the imagery is just so striking, and I guess maybe the production values were higher. But this is still a great movie.
Yeah. I polled some friends online. I'm part of this Facebook group called The Gyre. It's just like a bunch of random film fans, mostly like Criterion enthusiasts. So shout out to those guys. But they've been recently posting, like, what's your favorite Bergman film? What's your favorite Kurosawa film? So I posted, what's your favorite Mizoguchi film? Kind of expected Ugetsu to get up there just because it's so highly regarded by a lot of filmmakers. But it was pretty much like hands down Sancho the Bailiff, which I was like, oh man, did we pick the wrong films to review? Like, because we're just planning to do two Mizoguchi films. But I definitely have that on my list because there's some high praise from a lot of well-versed film fans.
Apparently
there.
We're just too mainstream.
And we're just... I thought we were getting obscure with Ugetsu. And,
me too. And I was scared we were going to alienate people.
Oh, no, I'm sure there's plenty of people out there to alienate.
Yeah.
But yeah, definitely check out other Mizoguchi films if you haven't. Like I said, Sancho the Bailiff is the next one on my list to see. It's supposed to be his best by a lot of people I respect. So I'm looking forward to that. Well, that concludes our main review. We're going to get into the trivia battle now, see if Nick can dethrone me as the trivia king. So, Nick, I'll give you the first chance. You can ask me a question.
I want to win so badly, but I'm scared I'm going to pick an easy question and choke. I'm going to pick one I don't know the answer to.
Okay. Hoping that I won't know it as well.
Like, really vainly going to just hope that you don't know the answer to it. Let's see. In which indie film does Ally Sheedy play a drug addict? A. Claire Dolan, 1998. B. Sugartown, 1999. C. The Addiction, 1995. D. High Art, 1998.
I have no idea. I'm going to go with D. High Art.
Oh, Jordan. No.
Was it High Art?
Oh, you jerk. Oh, you're going to win again.
Oh, no. I don't even remember who the actress or the film was that you're talking about.
What kind
about.
Of gree-gree are you putting on me here, man?
Oh, man.
Where's your rabbit's foot?
So, question for you, Nick. Which prison film centers on a convict who founds a theater group? A. Weeds from 1987. B. The Shawshank Redemption from 1995. C. The Longest Yard from 1974. Or D. Brubaker from 1980.
Well, B and C are out. What was A?
A was Weeds.
Let's just go Brubaker. Let's go D, Brubaker. Let me guess. It's A, Weeds.
It was A, Weeds. So that means I win. Woo! All right, so I get to assign you something. Maybe I should assign you another Mizoguchi since I'm going to watch Sancho the Bailiff get you to watch that as well.
All right, let's do it.
Cool. Yeah, let's do that. And Nick, you want to tell us a little bit about our main film for next time?
Yes, we're going to switch gears, but not that much, to another Japanese director. We've talked about him a lot already.
You might have heard of him.
Kurosawa. We're going to watch Dreams. It's one of his late films. It's in color. I've always wanted to watch it. I've seen almost all of the rest of his movies. I've never seen that one.
That'll be fun to talk about. It's been a while since I've seen it, and I think you used the word impressionistic for Ugetsu when we talked about it. There's definitely literally some impressionism in that film, so we'll discover that as we watch Dreams. I think it's 1990 by Akira Kurosawa. All right. Well, Nick, where can we find you online?
TheNickSperiment.blogspot.com. We'll probably post a link in there. I reviewed both movies that we talked about today, so I'll go into a lot more detail with Chunking Express. But I write fairly brief reviews. I don't like to ramble. I just copy Roger Ebert's style as best I can. No one notices, but I just said that. So
nice. Well, yeah, I'll definitely include a link for that in the show notes. If you guys aren't already subscribed on Apple Podcast or Google Podcast or wherever you find your podcasts, go and subscribe. Leave us a nice star rating if you don't mind. You can also find our show on 25thframemedia.com. And we're produced in part by East Baton Rouge Parish Library. So you can check out our library that sponsors this, that provides an innovation space where you can record your own podcast if you're in the Baton Rouge area. Find them online at ebrpl.com. And give us also, if you have any feedback or want to send us a trivia question or just a comment about the show, you can email us at filmshakepodcast@gmail.com. All right. Well, we'll see you guys next month for Dreams when we talk about that. I'm sure you can find the film online or at your public library. Watch it or don't. We'll have a spoiler-free review of that as well as a spoilers episode. So see you next time.
Take it easy.